as the country was first established, there was a pastor in Plymouth named Henry Ward Beecher. And if you have ever received hate mail, you might be able to relate to what he came into one Sunday morning when he arrived at church and they handed him a stack of mail. He started reading through it, and on one of the items, one of the different letters, it just gave one word. All it said was fool. And so when he came up before the congregation that morning, he introduced this particular letter to the people and just mentioned to them that he has received many letters over the years with the text there without somebody signing who it was that had written it. But never before had he actually received somebody's signature without the text of the letter. So often we hear people call each other names like that. And in the passage we're dealing with here in Luke, it was Jesus who was the one who had called this man a fool. Now, fool in the Bible is very strong language. It's a strong rebuke. And the Proverbs deals with the way of the fool at length. It's the fool, for example, who doesn't want to learn from others, but only desires to share his own opinion. He's unwilling to listen to the counsel of others. For him to turn away from his evil ways is itself foolish. He refuses to. It says that he thinks that's the evil thing, just to turn from evil. He's unable to see his own ways and how destructive the end of that foolishness is. He sees the danger, and it says in Proverbs, and he walks right into it and suffers for it. You see, the fool is not the one who does foolish things, first of all, but it's the one who does those foolish things but doesn't recognize them to be what they are. It says in Proverbs 12:15, the way of the fool is right in his own eyes. He just doesn't have within himself the wisdom enough to listen to rebuke, to even turn his eyes on himself and hear it and respond. He is so comfortable with where he is, even though it is just foolishness. So we want to be very careful as we come to this passage and listen to Jesus' rebuke against this man, where he called this man a fool. We want to be very careful that we are not guilty of the same foolishness that this man was guilty of. Now, it'd be easy in a passage like this to read over it and even maybe recognize some of the things that this man was foolish for, and yet think it's all about somebody else. So let's do what we can and assume that Jesus is speaking to me, that Jesus is speaking to you when he addresses the crowd here and says, fool, right? Let's assume that he's talking to us. It's our goal to understand what it was that Jesus was rebuking about this man so that we can avoid the same thing. We need to approach this passage very humbly so that we don't remain the fool the same way. Now, we began this passage last week in Luke chapter 12, and we saw that in verses 13 and 14, one of the things that made this man the fool was that he was demanding his own rights. It said in verse 13 and 14, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But Jesus responded to him. He said, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbitrator over you?" This man was coming to Jesus because there was a great injustice done to him. The law of Moses was very specific on how the inheritance of a father was passed down to his sons. And here was one of those sons who was not getting his share. His other brothers were perhaps stealing it from him. Maybe he was the older brother that was supposed to get the 2/3 of the family inheritance. Or maybe he was one of the other brothers that was getting gypped by his older brother. We're not told which brother it was, but somehow he was being taken advantage of. And he came to Jesus, this rabbi, and said, "Lord, make it right. You have the authority. Let's set these things in place." He was frustrated. We can all relate to that because we've all been abused and mistreated in different ways. And this guy was standing up for it. Justice is good. It's right that the people get what they deserve. It's right that if you have this by the law, that you should get it. But injustice is inevitable. It's going to happen. You're going to be mistreated throughout life. The question is, how do we handle it? And recognize that as Christians, we're called not just to get our own, And Jesus' ministry is not about just giving it to us. It's about taking our hearts and redirecting them to the Lord and sacrificing of our rights in order to help others. This is what the Lord was calling this man to do. And so instead of giving this man his rights, he said, I am no arbitrator of your situation. I'm not here to decide between people who gets what. But he said, I want your heart for me. He said, give those things up. Let your brother have the whole thing if that's what it takes. He said, I want your heart. Second of all, we saw in verse 15 that this was the fool because of his selfish desire for riches. Verse 15 said, then the Lord said to the whole crowd, he said, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. Or some of your translations would say covetousness there. Be strong in your guard against covetousness within you. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. See, greed was what was motivating this particular individual to demand his rights. He said, I want this because it's my right. And Jesus was attacking the heart behind it all as greed, saying, look, your problem is covetousness. See, greed has at its very heart this desire to get what it wants, to go where it wants, to go and do what it wants to do, and really not have to concern itself with how it's going to be afforded, where the money is going to come from to pay for it. This was behind what this man's struggle was. He wanted the good life, and he felt like he could measure this by the amount of possessions that he had. And so Jesus addressed him and said, you need to fight against this greed. This greed is the enemy within you. Your enemy is not your brother. Your fight is within your own soul. You want to practice self-denial and choose contentment in God. These are the things that you need to be doing with yourself. Which brings us to verses 16 and following, which is the parable that Jesus tells then to really explain this covetousness. What is this covetousness look like? That is the struggle, the problem with this man that Jesus is addressing here. And he gives us this parable, this story in verses 16 through 20. Let me read it. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease. Eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So the third point that we want to see here, and the first that we'll be dealing with today, is this foolish investment of wealth. You see, he was asking the right question. He was asking, how do I invest for my future? I have a productive land. This year was a bumper crop. It's a great problem to have. He didn't have any need of anything else. He had no more room for all of his stuff. He just kept storing it up, and he said, what do I do with it all now? I have so much stuff. And it is so much like our situation, our problem, if you will, in America. We are so affluent. We've been given so many blessings, just material things, just the cars out here in the parking lot, our homes, each one of us possess, the bank accounts and everything. We have so much wealth over against the wealth of other nations, not only in our own day, but throughout history. We're amazingly wealthy, even as this particular man was. And yet he was a fool because of the way he invested that wealth. And so we want to think about this same question. How do I deal with my money? What do I do with my crops? What do I do with all the goods that I have? Because I have so much to handle here. And I want to consider five principles that we should be thinking of considering when we go to make decisions about how we handle our goods. What do we do with our money? What do we do with our property and all that God has given us? The first one I want to look at is the fact that God calls us to work hard to actually meet our own basic needs, if possible. For example, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, Paul writes, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work hard. He says, work with your hands, just as we commanded you, so that, and here's the purpose of it all, so that you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. So in other words, so that you're not in any need, work hard and provide for yourself. Have an income. Don't constantly be draining off other people, which was one of the struggles that the church in Thessalonica had that Paul was addressing. The church there was in belief that the Lord was coming back so soon that they could all just quit their jobs and basically coast through life, just depending on the giving of everybody else toward them. And he's all, no, you need to get a job. You need to work and provide for yourselves. Similarly, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, Paul wrote, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, for his family, he is denied the faith, and he is worse than an unbeliever. So clearly, the Lord has called upon us as his people to take care of ourselves, to provide an income so that we aren't in any need and aren't a burden to other people, and so on. This implies, then, that there's nothing wrong with a savings account. There's nothing wrong with a retirement account and planning for your needs and accepting the fact that things are going to happen. Your car is going to break down. There's things that are going to come up. You should have food saved up in your pantry. Whatever it is that you need to do to plan for those very practical, foreseeable, physical needs that will come. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not that you're lacking trust in God because you have a savings account and you're afraid he may not provide for you. That's not a problem. The second principle we need to keep in mind for making a wise decision about how we invest for our future is that God is the giver of all wealth. The farmer can plant and cultivate, but God is the one who gives life. He is the one who causes the growth. A man, a farmer, or any one of us cannot make ourselves wealthy apart from God's sovereign work behind it all. Psalm 127, verse 2, I think, illustrates this well. The psalmist writes that it is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful laborers. It's vain for you to work really, really hard to gain money and to have food for yourself. And this is why, because God gives to his beloved even in their sleep. God takes care of his people. So it's not that God does that apart from our working, but as we work hard, God is the one ultimately that provides for us. That's why Paul can say in 1 Corinthians 4, he says, what do you have that you haven't received? And if you did receive it, and it's not something that you worked for on your own apart from God's help, then why do you boast as if you didn't receive it? Why do you boast as if it was all about you? It's not that we aren't to work. It's not that we just sit and wait for the pie to fall from the sky. We don't. We work hard, but recognizing all the while that God is the giver, ultimately, of all that we possess. That's the second point. So the question that arises out of this fact that God is the giver of all these things is then, if he has given it to us, what is his intention for it? That is, what does he want us to do with it? If all that we have is a gift from God, then he must have a purpose for it. And chances are it's not the way this man used it in our story, which is what made him the fool. The third principle is that God calls us to help meet the needs of others. We want to make money. We want to get a good job. That's fine. But the purpose is that we would give it away. So interesting. In Ephesians 4:28, it says this. He who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good. And here's the purpose. So that he will have something to share with one who has need. You know, when the rain falls, picture this kind of society where they're so dependent upon the water and the rains to provide crops and so on. When the rain falls on this hill and you've got your house up on top of the hill and you've got your big water tank and the water just fills it up, we should allow that water to overflow our own water container, if you will, and run down to the people below the hill in the valleys who maybe don't get quite the rain. It's kind of what Jesus is saying here. But sometimes this kind of willingness to give to others and help others in need really means sacrifice on our part and not just giving off of top. It's not just giving the surplus. Sometimes when the people in the valley are thirsty and in need of water, it hasn't rained up on the mountain either where we might live. Sometimes we have to actually give of the water at the bottom of our barrel, so to speak, to the people who have need and sacrifice ourselves to help those perhaps less fortunate and even treat those people as more important than ourselves. We can get by with so much less than what we so often do. We tend to define our needs as those things that make us comfortable or happier, as those circumstances were what really gives this kind of comfort and joy. Fourth, God calls us to use our money strategically to actually see the gospel progress in the world. We want to be giving and generous, not just toward those in need outside in the world and the community, but even within the body of Christ, so that the watching world sees the body of Christ working with each other, like it did in the early church in the first chapters of Acts, where the people were willing to share and give to whoever had need so that nobody lacked anything. What a powerful testimony that was to the people in that day, just as it would be to the people in our own day. We also want to use our resources, time, energy, money, whatever it is, to, as it says later in the Gospels, to make friends in heaven. To actually, in a sense, buy things that matter eternally. And not just tie our monies and our resources up to things that are here that just go away over time. See, people that are reached, even if it's not through your direct verbal communication of the gospel to another person, sometimes even through your resources and your giving to missions and so on, you're actually having a part in seeing the gospel move forward and progress in the world, and you're actually making friends for eternity. You're having a part in that through your giving. And fifth, which is really the bottom line of it all, is the way that you spend your money reveals where your heart is. In Luke 16, verse 13, Jesus taught, he said, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other." And he explains what he means by this. He said, you cannot serve both God and wealth. If you're serving wealth, if you're striving after money and making more of it all the time, then don't call yourself a servant of God, because you can't have both. Which is why he also explained a couple chapters later in Luke 18, he said, how hard it is for those who are wealthy to enter into the kingdom of God. It is easier for a camel to fit through, to be shoved through the eye of this needle, than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. Why? Because they are so dependent upon their riches and not God. Their affections have been really redirected toward those things that they pursue. See, we can show in our own lives that God is more important to us than our wealth. When we don't have money, we're content with it. And we're not just greedy for more. When we do have an abundance, we're not greedy again, but rather generous. This is how we show that God is more important to us than our money, our wealth. So, the problem. This particular man didn't think through those things. He asked the right question, right? He said, okay, what do I do with all this money? What do I do with all my grain? It's filling up these barns. But he had the wrong answer. And our tendency is to really do just what this man did. It's to take what God has given, ignore these principles, and spend all of this in personal pursuit of various pleasures that we just think will float our boat. This particular man in verses 18 through 20, look again at what he said. He said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. Right? He already had enough. He had everything he needed. He already had barns to store things in. And his problem was they weren't big enough because his land had become so productive. He was so wealthy. So what do I do with my problem? I know, I will build bigger barns. It's interesting. He was reasoning with himself, it says, instead of really considering God's thought on the matter. He has worked in this field all his life, planning, putting aside grain diligently every year, whatever percentage it was that he didn't need to eat, it went into savings. In case a drought might come, he was out of the reach of any kind of drought or famine that might come against their land. And now his land is producing in abundance. Finally, it's payday. Finally, he can get what he deserves. He said, I will enjoy the fruit of my labor. I have worked so hard for this, and now in the remaining years of my life, it's mine. I'm going to sit back, enjoy myself. I want to spend the remainder of my life leisurely enjoying my hobbies, maybe putzing around a little bit in a shop, collecting some collectibles, golfing, fishing, just sitting around, watching TV if I have to or want to, anything. This is the life that I want for myself. He says, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry. We can relate to this. This is everywhere in our culture. But he failed to realize that his wealth was not his own. Notice in verses 17 to 19, all of the personal pronouns here, the my. He began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, it's all about my. It's all his. He failed to recognize the fact that God is behind all these things, that God has given this to him. God has given it to him as a stewardship, a loan, so to speak. And one day God's going to come back to collect. How did you handle all that I gave you? He's going to say. He's going to judge the way that you use what he has given you. Jesus would have you invest your wealth in a place where it's really safe. Not in a place where it's all going to be lost and burn up or blow away or rust or whatever. Thieves can't steal what's given to eternity. The rise and the fall of the economy can't touch eternal investments. Disease and death, they can't destroy them. This will of a greedy investor said this, I bequeath my own soul to the devil for being so greedy for the muck of this world. Right, when you're at the end of life, suddenly all that stuff just seems to fade away as to its significance. And second, he said, I give my wife's soul to the devil for persuading me to this worldly course of life. And third, my pastor's soul to the devil, because he didn't show me the danger that I lived in, nor reprove me for it. How foolish it is to just waste the whole life pursuing money, to pursue wealth, bigger barns for more grain, for what? This particular man failed to realize that this money was not his own, that it was ultimately from God. And not only that, but that his life was on loan from God as well. It's as though he never even thought that his life might be cut short. Fool, Jesus said, this very night your soul is required of you. He had all these plans and purposes for the future. And Jesus said, you fool, it's over. You're at the end. Instead of bigger barns, he was going to be buried. Instead of a long, luxurious retirement lounging on sandy beach someplace, he'd awake before the judgment seat of God, somehow giving an account of what he's done with himself, what he's done with all the Lord has given him. You see, it was God who was requiring his soul. In Hebrews 9:27, it says, it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. That is true for every one of you. For everyone on earth, Christian or non-Christian, we will answer to the Lord. Unbeknownst to him, God had arranged the day of his death. The number of his days were set, and they were ticking down. The beats of his heart were nearing their appointed end. And every second that goes by, it's the same for us too. We don't know when that appointed end will come. Yet he was living and planning like his tomorrow was certain. We all know that couple who has worked so hard, lived so diligently to set all this stuff aside, to finally retire at an early age and travel the world together, and they have all these great expectations and plans for what they're going to do with themselves. And then what happens? One gets sick, maybe spends a few years in bed, the other at their bedside, and all of this just vanishes, all their hopes, all their dreams. And that's if they're lucky and they live. Here he was, getting ready to stand before his Maker and answer for how he had squandered the resources God had given him, while the work of the gospel went forward without proper funding, while people in their neighborhood went poor and hungry. They were traveling the world, or at least expecting to. Now he's going to stand before the judgment seat of God. What's he going to show for it? A suntan? The shells he collected on the beaches along the way? Look at my shells, God. Is that it? What are you going to show? Knowing that the days of our life are few should really make us zealous to use them wisely. Listen, if we are to avoid being the fool that Jesus is speaking to here, we have to be willing to consider the reality of death. It's not comfortable, we don't like it, but it's real. This is a real challenge for us because we're in a society that has numbed us to this whole fact of death, of dying. We are hidden from it. Many of us in the room probably never even seen somebody die. They're covered up immediately and gotten out of the way. We don't ever have to confront it. Most cultures throughout history haven't been like that. It's completely absent from our day-to-day living. You can go throughout town and live among people for years and never confront one dead person, except where it's fake. On the TV or the movies, Hollywood's presentation, and there it's so overly graphic, and we know it's fake, that we're just numbed to it. And so death, it's not really a big deal. We tend to think that we're inevitable, we'll just keep living, because we never see people die. Except for where it's fake, so people talk about death, and somehow we just kind of relegate it over to the realm of, yeah, I kind of know it's right, but it's just not real to me. That's how we live. It wasn't how everybody lived. It certainly wasn't how Jonathan Edwards lived. And if we don't consider what death really means, we won't consider how to live in its shadow. As a 19-year-old, Jonathan Edwards, who was the greatest theologian America has ever produced, in 1722, he wrote these resolutions. There were a whole bunch of them, a whole list of them. I think there's 70 of them. And he would read these on a regular basis just to remind himself of the principles that he wanted to gauge and govern his life by. I just want to show you some of them that relate to dying. The 9th one that he wrote: resolved to think much on all occasions of my own dying, and of the common circumstances which attend death. That is, all the various ways that a person might die. 7, he said, I'm resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. Again, why does this matter? Is because one day at that hour, once that hour is passed, he'll stand before the Lord and have to give an account, right? So in that last hour, I don't want to be doing something that I would be ashamed of when that hour was passed. 50, he says, resolved, I will act so as I think I shall judge would have been best and most prudent when I come into the future world. So one day, once this life is passed, I'm actually standing before the Lord. In that day, I will be able to look back on my life now and say, this is the way I would have liked to have lived. Right? And we know what that way is. The question is, are we willing now, on the front end of it, to say, I'm willing to live it, and not wait until the back end to actually look back and regret? Similarly, in 51, he said, resolved that I will act so in every respect as I think I shall wish I had done, if I should at last be damned. So now he's putting himself in hell after he's died. And he's saying, if it were such that I would be damned, if I go to hell, how is it that the man in hell wishes he would live on earth? That's how I want to live now as a 19-year-old. And here probably a 20-year-old by the time he wrote that one. 52, he said, I frequently hear persons in old age say how they would live if they were to live their lives over again. Resolved that I will live just so as I can think I shall wish I had done, supposing I live to old age. 55, resolved to endeavor to my utmost to act as I can think I should do if I had already seen the happiness of heaven and the hell torments. Our friend in the passage had no such resolutions. He acted like he could control his future. He acted like it was all there, that he could control. I'm going to die here. I'm going to live for a while. I've got these years laid up for me. This is my future. This was his plans. This is how he lived. But life is so fragile. It hangs by a thread, cut so easily at any moment by heart attack, cancer, car wreck, any number of things. 4, verse 14 says, your life is a vapor that appears for a little while and then it vanishes away. Psalm 49, verse 11 and 12 said, "The inner thought of the rich is that their houses last forever, their dwelling places to all generations. They have named their lands after themselves. But man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beast that perishes." Fool, now that you're dead, all that you've saved, Jesus says, waiting for the right time to spend it, hoping that someday you'll be able to just use it in ways that just make life easy, now it's going to be spent by someone else. You're going to have no control over it. It's gone. That's basically what he says at the end of verse 20. Now who will own what you have prepared? Right? Now what good is it going to do you? You can't take any of it with you. It's gone. There are so many examples throughout history of people who have lived with this kind of resolution, with this kind of determination not to waste life. Raymond Lull, born in 1235, we'll go way back, Spanish missionary to Muslim North Africa for years, was finally driven out from North Africa and later taught as a professor of Arabic, because he knew the language so well, in Spain, until he was 79 years old. He was done teaching in the eyes of a lot of people. His friends told him, "Retire. Why don't you just enjoy learning and reading books and do whatever you want to do that way?" Instead of spending the last days of his life in peace and comfort, though, he went back to North Africa. And he worked in secrecy for a whole year with the people that he had led to the Lord years prior. Until finally he decided he would make his presence there again public. So he went boldly right into the open square and announced that he had returned. He wasn't trying to hide who he was. He announced that he had returned and started proclaiming the gospel to the people that were in the square there, telling them that if they do not receive the message that he was presenting, that this is the result. It is the kind of judgment and hell that the Bible teaches. And they were so angry with him, filled with rage. They drug him out of town and stoned him to death. You think, what? Why would I follow that kind of example? Why would I want that for myself? And obviously, we're not going to have that kind of result ultimately here, but why would I even want that as an example? But I tell you, we tell stories like that. We still read about people 800 years later who had that kind of courage. We don't read about the guy who retired comfortably on the coast in Florida. That's not who we read about. We read about people who are willing to give of themselves for purposes that were greater than their own comfort and pleasure. There's a 78-year-old mother of John Insor, who I think is a good example as well. John Insor is the pastor. He was also a pro-life advocate. But his mother had very bad health, but she wasn't willing to stop. She just kept ministering to the people around her. She went on a missions trip over to Guatemala to help teach these 90 leaders or teachers, various Bible study teachers and so on, just how to study the Bible better. On the way, though, their bus was ambushed, the driver was killed. But she was just rejoicing just to have the opportunity to help people understand the Bible better. A friend of ours, her name is Gladys, a prayer warrior. She corresponds with me on a regular basis, just asking how you people are doing, wanting names and stories. And so I'll tell her about you. And this is somebody that we really don't even know that well. 10 years ago, I shoveled snow from her driveway over the course of a winter. That's it. She was a widow. But prior to that, she and her husband, Max, would go over to China. And at that time, it was very difficult to get over there. And so they were teachers. They were both educators. And so they would go there and teach English to the Chinese. And this was their way of getting the gospel to the people. And so they saw converts, and they were able to witness to the underground church and so on. To this day, most of her time, she just told me in her last email to me, most of her time is spent corresponding with believers over in China, trying to encourage them and help them. What time she's not spending praying for people like us? If she's praying for us the way that she is, how many others is she on her knees praying for on a regular basis? She's not wasting her life. Charles Simeon, 200 years ago, a pastor in Cambridge, England, was forced to stop his ministry after 25 years. He was only 47 years old. His health was just so bad, he had to stop. And so for 13 years, he struggled with this bad health, fighting it all the time. He was too weak to do anything for anyone else until he was 60. And when he was 60, his health returned suddenly. He couldn't explain it. There was no physical changes in terms of this, the outward things. It just, he had all the strength and more that he ever had when he was 60, out of nowhere. He was convinced that the Lord had been teaching him through all of this that his life wasn't just to suddenly come to a stop, that his service and ministry wasn't just to come to a stop when he was 60, because that was his goal. He had always told himself, when I turn 60, I'm done. I'm going to enjoy my life and basically take it easy from here on out. The Lord stripped him, therefore, from those 13 years and put it on at the end of his life and said, now you serve me to the end. And he did. Ralph Winter, who died last year at 84 years old, was a founder of the U.S. Center for World Missions. He wrote this. He said, most men don't die of old age. They die of retirement. Just like other drugs, other psychological addictions, retirement is a disease, not a blessing. Where in the Bible do they retire? Did Moses retire? Paul? Peter? John? Do military officers retire in the middle of a war? We are in a battle. We need to live like it. It is a spiritual battle. We're fighting for the souls of lost people who have eternity waiting, for whom death is towering over them and shadowing our existence. And we go through life doing what? Worrying about our suntans and our travel. Why? What is that about? Do we recognize the gravity of what's going on here? Psalm 71, verse 18 says this, even when I'm old and gray, O God, do not forsake me until I declare your strength to this generation, your power to all who are to come. Give us that kind of passion with our lives. Anything else is wasted. With this decision to invest his money by building bigger barns shows his value system was twisted. He had his treasure in the wrong place. Or according to this fourth point, he had a foolish estimate of worth. It says in verse 21, so is the man. That is, just as this story illustrates, so is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. It comes down to this decision. Will we be the fool who stores up treasure for himself or join the few others who are willing to be rich in God? The man in the story chose greed, to take it easy, to eat, drink, be merry, to have the good life as explained and defined by society. He expected to be fully satisfied in the things that money could purchase. He planned to enjoy heaven on earth in his last days. His treasure was a perfect retirement, lots of money, and very little requirements and commitments on his part. And yet even the most wealthy, I know you've seen this, even the most wealthy live without real joy, don't they? It's not about how much you have to somehow buy satisfaction and comfort and joy. There's a deeper reality going on. Solomon is a great example of one who gave himself up looking for pleasure in every place he could find, under every stone. He said to himself, enjoy yourself. He wanted that for himself. He tried wine. He built houses, planted vineyards and gardens. He made parks complete with ponds and all kinds of fruit trees. He owned innumerable slaves, had his own singers, and enjoyed all he wanted of the pleasures of men, which were many concubines. He possessed larger flocks and herds more than anyone else. He collected for himself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. And finally, he says this in Ecclesiastes 2. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Thus I considered all my activities which my hand had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity. Striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. It was all pointless. I had it all and it was not worth it. See, real joy is found only in God. This joy is known even among the wealthy only when their riches are used wisely. This joy is full even when the pocketbooks are empty. This joy promises a future that actually is secure. Unlike the stock market, you put your money in the bank on the other side of the river and wait till you cross it in death and it's all there for you. You plant all your treasures and you do everything here and it's going to vanish. The foolishness of our ways. We think somehow we can control our lives and live it all up for right now, completely ignoring the fact that eternity is waiting for us. If we try to have both, which is what we typically are guilty of within the church in America, we try to follow God and yet pursue pleasures and worldliness on the other hand, we will fail. It's impossible. That's what Jesus meant when he said, it's so hard, you can't get a rich guy into the doors of the kingdom because they love themselves too much. They're too dependent on their wealth. They forgot that everything comes from God. And they want those things so bad. They want more all the time. The deceitfulness of the riches have choked away every desire for God and his word. You see, if we really are rich toward God, we will submit our pursuit of this American dream to always have more and make something of ourselves to the eternal good God. See, the freedom that we have in this country, which we need to treasure and be excited about and celebrate on a day like today, is not just about getting more stuff. It's not about having the two-car garage and the dog and whatever else. It's about having freedom to worship. It's about having freedom to actually follow this God who calls us to himself this way. You see, if we are really rich toward God, we will be thankful for what he has given us and use it as he instructs us, being hardworking, responsible, frugal with regard to ourselves, but very generous toward others, very gospel-minded in our living, in our giving, our priorities. We'll follow the example of Christ, who became poor for our sakes, so that we, even though we are poor, may, through his poverty, through his humiliation, becoming a man and even dying for us, become truly rich. We are guilty of selfishness, of greed, of covetousness, of treasuring the wrong things instead of God. And yet it's that kind of misplaced value system that the Lord comes and pays the penalty for in his death. That's where our joy is. That's where our comfort and our eternal riches will be found, is in Jesus Christ because of what he has done.
Father, we thank you again for allowing us the privilege of coming together before your word, before the authority of Almighty God as you have spoken to us so clearly in it. And I pray that we as your people would bow the knee in humility, that we would submit our wills and our lives before you, because so often the direction of our lives goes in such contrary ways as what you have prescribed for us. Draw us to yourself for your name's sake. Amen.